I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Seth Farber, the founder and director of E-Team, the Jewish Life Advocacy Center, which works to increase participation in Jewish life by making Israel's religious establishment responsive to the diverse Jewish needs of the Jewish people. Discussing the Israeli Supreme Court decision accepting non-ultra-Orthodox conversions to Judaism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. This is the last week of preparation before the holiday of Passover, which begins this Saturday night, March 27th. And there's nothing that says Pesach more than cleaning, cooking, and preparing. While some people think that a non-Jewish holiday, like, say, Christmas, might take more preparation than any other festival, after all, people actually cut down trees, drag them into their living rooms, and set them up to die there for a few weeks. In truth, most of the holiday preparations for December 25th are actually not integral to that festival. Trees, electric lights, statues of reindeer, expensive presents, they are not religiously mandated, didn't even begin to be part of that celebration until the 19th or even the 20th centuries. But Passover, Pesach preparations are actually commanded in a series of tremendously ancient texts, beginning with the description of the very first Passover some 3,250 years ago, on the night before we got out of slavery in Egypt. In the Torah in Exodus, and later in other regulations specified in Numbers and Deuteronomy, we're told that on the Leil Shimurim, the watch night of the 14th of Nisan, we are to spend the evening, maybe the whole night, telling the story of the Exodus from Egypt and our flight to freedom. We are supposed to eat the roasted Paschal lamb, the leaping sheep of freedom, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and to teach our children the lesson of slavery and God's redemption to freedom. And we are commanded, not advised, but ordered, to eat only unleavened foods for the week that follows, and to remove all chametz from our homes. If we live in Israel, we are told to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover there. The mitzvot, the commandments, are quite explicit and very ancient. But that doesn't end the discussion or the requirements. The rabbis of the Mishnah, completed nearly 1,800 years ago, and their successors who created the Gemara, finished about 1,500 years ago, added an entire array of ways to observe the Passover that extended its sway into every area of our homes and our lives. The rabbis start by asking what it means to remove leavening, chametz, from your home. They create a whole system that requires the most thorough spring cleaning imaginable, moving furniture and bookcases, unearthing closets, taking out every possible form of wheat or other grain-based products from your home, and removing or cleaning every plate, platter, utensil, or appliance that has come into any contact with leavening. That process of bedikat chametz, searching for chametz, mechirat chametz, selling the chametz, and finally biur chametz, burning the chametz, culminates in about a week, by the way. Well, it's a complicated observance indeed. Once you've removed, finally, all the chametz from your house, technically you don't need to throw it out or even give it away. You can store it safely in a garage or a sealed cabinet and formally sell it to a non-Jew for a nominal sum for the week of Pesach. This process is actually used in Israel for huge corporations like Osem that produce baked goods for the entire nation. Anyway, after technically selling off the chametz, this mechirat chametz process, by the way, I've always wondered what would happen if the guy who owns all the chametz in Israel decides after Pesach not to sell it back. Anyway, after you sell off the chametz and search for any leftover leaven, whatever is remaining is burned. That process, Biur Chametz, is actually pretty fun. You gather the last boxes of cereal, the leftover rolls, Pop-Tarts, and so on, and using a can or a foil enclosure, or, here in the Southwest, a chiminea, or whatever combustion chamber you have handy, you just burn it all up. I recall living in Jerusalem and walking home the morning before the first Seder, seeing small fires on every corner, and some not-so-small ones, people burning their chametz in final preparation for Passover. It was a great cathartic moment, casting off your last bits of impurity before observing the great rituals of the Festival of Freedom. Of course, if the preparations for Passover simply included getting rid of chametz, this holiday'd be pretty easy. But it turns out there are many, many other things you need to do to get ready for the Passover Seder, the most rigorously structured educational meal ever. This means having matzah, the unleavened bread, wine, or grape juice enough for 4 cups for everybody to drink, bitter herbs in 2 forms, hard-boiled eggs, parsley or other spring vegetables, charoset, the chopped fruit-nut mixture that's made to look like mortar, and so on. And all that is before you even eat your meal, which in Ashkenazic tradition includes gefilte fish, hot chicken soup with matzo balls, brisket, other heavy main dishes. Interestingly, very few Jews really eat lamb on Passover. And various kosher for Passover kugels, and if you still have room, non-rising desserts. The work involved in the Pesach Seder actually turns free Jewish people into slaves once more, at least in the preparation phase, and the post-Seder cleanup is no less onerous than the prep. And then, if you are Orthodox or conservative or traditional in some other way, you do it all over again for the second night Seder. All that labor, well, it actually makes you appreciate freedom more fully, especially when Passover is over. And so, to play us in on this final Sunday before Pesach, here's a setting of V'hi She'amda L'Avotenu from the Haggadah for Passover. This is what preserved our fathers and keeps us God and God's redemption. For not only one tyrant arose and tried to destroy us, but in every generation they do. And God saves us repeatedly from their hands. V'hi She'amda.
V'hi She'amda. Lavotenu Vehi she'amda Lavotenu velanu Shelo echad bilvad Amad aleinu lechaloteinu Amad aleinu lechaloteinu Vehi she'amda Lavotenu והיא שעמדה לאבותינו ולנו שלא אחד בלבד עמד עלינו לכלותינו עמד עלינו לכלותינו והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו מצילנו והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו מצילנו מידם והיא שעמדה והיא שעמדה לאבותינו ולנו שלא אחד בלבד עמד עלינו לכלותינו עמד עלינו לכלותינו והקדוש ברוך הוא מצילנו
That was V'hi She'amda from the Passover Seder, sung by Yossi Azulai, coming up Saturday night, just 6 days from now. Don't miss our Facebook event. Congregation Beit Simcha is a part together, a seat at the Rabbi's Seder table. Go to Facebook/Beit Simcha Tucson to sign up. When we return on Two Jewish, in just a moment, our guest, Rabbi Seth Farber, founder and director of E-Team, which works to help Russian Jews and others in Israel become fully accepted as Jews in that society. We'll discuss the recent Israeli Supreme Court decision accepting non-Orthodox conversions and much more when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson, the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tourists, may it be gone soon, a small group can join us in person every Friday night and Saturday morning. Just email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. We're getting close to 20 people. That doesn't sound like much, but spread out, wearing masks, still it's a congregation. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Shabbat services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll hold services with full music by virtual experience and in person, with our masked and careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, and many of them are in blended format in person, too. You can access those. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our religious school is also available in blended format, some kids in person, some online. Join us. Passover is coming up, and you have a chance to celebrate a part together by sitting at my Seder table, at least virtually. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information. In fact, for much more about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook Live, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Seth Farber is a founder and director of E-Team, an organization that deals with religion and state issues in Israel. An Orthodox rabbi and social activist, he founded E-Team back in 2002. It's almost 20 years ago. He's become a leading figure in religion and state issues in Israel. And we are talking about those kinds of issues this morning. Welcome to Two Jewish, Rabbi Farber.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So the recent Israeli Supreme Court decision in a 15-year case that permits the recognition of conversions by non-Orthodox rabbis may have profound implications. Can you give us a little background on it?
Sure. So Israel has two definitions, at least, of what it means to be Jewish on the legal front. One is for purposes of marriage, meaning that in Israel, Israel has adopted, since the founding of this state, the Turkish law that actually allows people to get married only by their religious faith. So Jews can only marry Jews with a rabbi, Christians can only marry Christians, Muslims can only marry Muslims, etc. And the group that's given the power to perform marriages in Israel is the chief rabbinate, which is exclusively Orthodox. But of course, Israel has another definition of Jewish for the purposes of immigration. Israel has a law called the Law of Return that allows people to emigrate here as Jews. And since the early 70s, that law has defined Jewish as anybody who is born to a Jewish parent or grandparent, or anybody who converted to Judaism in a recognized community. Now, over the years, there's been a debate, a longstanding debate, about what it means to convert in a recognized community for purposes of immigration, that is, for civil purposes. And in the 80s, there was a discussion about whether Reform communities and conservative communities, particularly in North America, if they perform conversions, would those be recognized? In 2002, there was another legal case, but in 2005, the main legal case came up, which is the one we're talking about now, where Reform communities in Israel said, we want to be recognized as legal recognized communities, certified communities, to perform conversions ourselves. And if people come to Israel, they're not citizens, and they convert with us, they want to be able to be recognized as Jews for the purposes of immigration. In other words, they can basically get citizenship here. That case took 15 years. It took 15 years because in this country, in a wonderful way, Judaism is linked, really, to the destiny of the Jewish people and the Jewish state. And because of that, it's very, very repercussive. Along the way, also, there's been some involvement of the Orthodox community. I'm an Orthodox rabbi, and I run a conversion court in Israel known as Giur Kahalacha. And our court also had a very similar petition that was petitioned to the Supreme Court. I'm a little oversimplifying, but in 2017, which took a lot less time, the court already recognized the right of Orthodox private conversion courts to be certified as recognized communities. And an Orthodox court, since 2017, that would convert someone in Israel, in most cases, would be able to then turn their status into recognized for purposes of immigration. So essentially, if I can just sum up, the discussion or the recent court decision of this week, which has really been going on for 15 years, but it was kind of the writing was on the wall. It was pretty obvious that the courts were going to rule in favor of the Reform and conservative communities. It only affects a handful of people a year, but it is very symbolic in the sense that it allows Reform and conservative conversion communities here in Israel, to be certified as recognized.
We will explore those issues in more depth, as well as some of the challenges of deciding who is Jewish in Israel when we come back in just a moment with our guest, Rabbi Seth Farber, here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. It's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. That's TooJewishRadio18@gmail. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there are a lot of non-Jews who actually speak Yiddish, the ever-dying language, as it's sometimes called, the language of the Jews of Eastern Europe and Central Europe to a degree. And a lot of them in America had important roles to play. I think of Colin Powell, but there's a number of others that come to mind as well.
Right, both famous people and less famous people. I had a dorm mate at Harvard who was from Brooklyn, and he was an Italian guy, Catholic, rode a motorcycle all the time, always wore leather jackets. He kind of stuck out at Harvard. But he spoke Yiddish better than any Jewish kid at Harvard because of the neighborhood he grew up in. And it was just part of the survival skills that he had picked up in Brooklyn. So Colin Powell, whom you mentioned, great Secretary of State, as a kid, worked as a Shabbos goy in Washington Heights. And by living with that family one day a week, he acquired a fluency in Yiddish.
So we should talk about the term Shabbos goy, which has kind of weird connotations, I think, for a lot of people. That's the person who comes in, and for Jews who couldn't, weren't allowed to turn on lights, light fires, heat food, they could do some of those things, even open the door with a key, provided they weren't told directly to do it. It's part of Jewish law.
Right. So nowadays, Orthodox Jews who keep all these commandments have machines. Like they have timers on lamps and other things that do it for them.
So, Shabbos ovens, Shabbos refrigerators. Even if you're not Jewish, you sometimes get one that has that mode.
So the institution of Shabbos goy has basically disappeared. But I think one thing important for your listeners to know is that goy didn't start out to be a pejorative term. It was merely descriptive. It was how Jews referred to anybody who wasn't Jewish. So to call somebody a Shabbos goy...
Actually, the term goy just means people. You can talk about goy kadosh. That's the people of Israel, technically speaking.
The holy people.
Yeah, the holy people. That's right.
Right. But apart from its technical meaning, it strikes many people today as pejorative. Didn't start out that way, and the term Shabbos goy was also not a pejorative term. Now, the interesting figure that we want to talk about a little bit today is Louis Armstrong, because who would have suspected, right? So Louis Armstrong, as a little kid, was very poor. His father abandoned him. He went to live with his grandmother. He lived in a very tough neighborhood in New Orleans, and sang with little boy friends on street corners, put out a hat, and people dropped in coins, and he kind of made a living that way. Well, this couple of Jewish immigrants from Lithuania heard him singing, and their hearts went out to him because he was obviously very poor and had a great smile his whole life. So they took him in. And it's a little bit vague as to whether they took him in as a Shabbos boy or an apprentice for the coal wagon that Mr. Karnofsky owned that went around.
Right.
But what exactly he did for them is less clear than the fact that they treated him like a Ben Byatt, like a son of the family. And to honor these adoptive parents, he wore a Magen David, a Star of David, around his neck till the day he died. And supposedly, according to some accounts, also learned Yiddish.
You know, it's funny. Another famous Shabbos goy, Elvis Presley in Memphis. It's fascinating that people that had those connections with the Jewish community. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We are now pleased and serene to bring you our randomly occurring feature of Too Jewish, Haikus for Jews from our Zen Judaism department. We opened the door for Elijah the prophet. Now our cat is gone. And, lacking fins or tail, the gefilte fish swims with great difficulty. That was our Zen Judaism segment, Haikus for Jews, for the coming festival of Passover this Saturday night. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. With Passover just a week away, the Jewish community in Madrid found itself in a desperate situation. There was an acute shortage of horseradish, key ingredient of the fiery condiment for gefilte fish, also known as chrein. A cry arose, and the whole community was mobilized in an effort to prevent this shameful shanda, this tragedy. The European Union countries gave the same reply. Sorry, due to the pandemic, we have none to send. In desperation, the Madrid rabbis phoned one of the yeshivas in Tel Aviv, begging them to send a crate of horseradish by air freight to Madrid. Just 2 days before Passover, a crate of grade A, tear-jerking Israeli horseradish was loaded onto a Ben-Gurion airport freight flight, came to Madrid, and all seemed to be well. Unfortunately, when the rabbi went to the Madrid airport to claim the horseradish, he was informed that a wildcat strike had just broken out. No shipments could be unloaded for at least a week. He was able to get just an ounce or two, not nearly enough for all the Jews of Spain. And so you guessed it. As a result, the grain in Spain stayed mainly on the plain. The grain in Spain stayed mainly on the plain. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. This week's Parsha is second in the book of Leviticus. It's called Tzav, the section that establishes rules for the various sacrifices offered in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Mishkan. These same sacrifices were later also offered in the temple in Jerusalem for, perhaps 1,000 years. There are many different types of sacrifices commanded in Tzav, burnt offerings, guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. One group of sacrificial offerings, however, stands out, the offerings of peace, the Zevach Shlamim. Among this higher category of offerings, one stands out highest, the Zevach Todah, the thanksgiving offering. The rabbis thought so highly of thanksgiving to God, they are quoted in the Talmud saying, "When the Messiah comes, all sacrifices will have completed their mission and be discontinued with one exception, the thanksgiving offering." That sacrifice will last forever, the rabbis say, even after the Messiah comes. Why? Because even in a perfect world, we must remember to give thanks, to be grateful for what we have. This Shabbat is also Shabbat HaGadol, the great Sabbath preceding Passover. The name is taken from its famous Haftarah, which proclaims the coming of the great and awesome day of God, in which the prophet Elijah will come and turn the hearts of children to their parents and the hearts of parents to their children. All of us experience challenges in our lives. All of us are experiencing challenge right now. But we do well to remember the many things we still have to feel grateful for. On the Shabbat of Tzav HaGadol, may we come to value those eternal blessings, family, friends, and the freedom to practice our faith at this special season of the year. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Seth Farber, explains what the new Supreme Court decision in Israel means for conversions to Judaism in the Jewish state. Hear all about it when we return on To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
We had two deaths of talented and unusual Jews last week. Yaphet Kotto was nominated for an Emmy for his performance as Ugandan dictator Idi Amin in a 1976 film about Entebbe, the deadly raid in which Israeli commandos freed Jewish passengers taken prisoner during a hijacking.
For those of you who do not know me, I am Field Marshal President for Life, Dr. Idi Amin Dada, the ruler of Uganda. I want to welcome you all to Uganda. I shall do everything within my power to make your stay a pleasant one here. I have arranged with the Palestinians.
Amin was just one of many notable roles for the actor Yaphet Kotto, who died last week at 81 after a decades-long career that included starring roles in Alien, Homicide, Life on the Street, and, the Bond movie Live and Let Die. He was, in fact, the first black actor to portray a James Bond villain. Kotto's role in Raid on Entebbe had many connections to his own life. Like Idi Amin, Kotto had roots in Africa. His father was a Cameroonian immigrant to the United States. Kotto said he was a descendant of that country's royal family. Kotto was also Jewish, like the passengers on the plane and the commandos who freed them. Kotto said he was frequently bullied as a child growing up because he was one of the few Jews in his neighborhood. He said that if he had not discovered acting, he would have become a rabbi. Look at all the films I've made. People say, how'd you do it? He said in 2019, I say, you realize how many movies I've made? No agent or manager got me those jobs. It's my faith that's gotten me everything. Cotto was born in 1939 in New York City to Avraham Cotto, who had converted to Judaism as a young man in Cameroon, and Gladys Marie, a nurse, who converted to Judaism before he was born. Raised in the Bronx, he said, it was rough. Going to shul, putting a yarmulke on, having to face people who were primarily Baptists in the Bronx meant that every Friday I was in some heavy fistfights. Acting was a refuge, and he was taking high-level theater classes as a teenager. He landed his first screen roles in the mid-60s. Cotto soon became a familiar face on TV and films. His role as the first black villain in a James Bond movie was in 1973's Live and Let Die, and in the 1990s, he played quite wonderfully a detective on the 7-season run of the Baltimore crime drama Homicide, Life on the Street.
We reach a certain age where we realize we know less about life than we did when we were 17. When I was 17, I remember. I believed in life. I trusted life. I believed there were answers to questions. I had hope. And right now, I want to tell you, I hate myself. I don't have any friends to speak of. All I have is this job. And it disgusts me.
After Homicide ended in 2000, Cotto appeared on screen just once more. In that interview in 2019, he said that while he now looked for the nearest deli rather than the local synagogue when he traveled, Judaism remained a lasting influence in his life. I still open every book I read from the back page to the front. My father instilled Judaism in me. Everything the Jewish religion stands for from an African's point of view, he left those things in me, especially things that had to do with the New Testament, which he was thoroughly, totally against. He said it was BS, Cotto recalled. If it weren't for him, I would have probably gone to hatred or violence or drugs or alcohol. I escaped all of those things because of Judaism. Cotto's wife of 24 years, Tessie Sinahan, said, you played a villain in some of your movies, but for me, you're a real hero, and to other people also. A good man, a good father, a good husband, and a decent human being. Very rare to find. Another death last week was a spectacularly talented but far more problematic figure, James Levine, a Cantor's grandson who led New York's Metropolitan Opera as artistic director for more than 40 years, won 8 Grammy Awards, transformed the Boston Symphony as its conductor, and conducted regularly in Europe as well, and appeared in the film Fantasia 2000, as well as having recorded many important compositions. But late in his career, James Levine was disgraced as a sexual abuser. He was 77 years old when he died last week. James Levine was one of the dominant figures in opera and American classical music until being fired in 2018. The face of sexual misconduct allegations that dated back to his guest conductor role at the Ravinia Music Festival near Chicago back in the 1980s. Rumors about Levine and sexual abuse, some dating back to the 1960s, circulated for decades. James Levine simultaneously served as music director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra from 2004 to 2011, and as music director of the Munich Philharmonic from 1999 to 2004 before that. He was born in Cincinnati. His father was a violinist, a dance band leader in the 1930s. His mother, Helen Goldstein Levine, was the daughter of a cantor and had a brief career as an actress. At the age of 10, James Levine made his solo debut during a youth concert at the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, performing Mendelssohn's Piano Concerto No. 2. He attended Juilliard, served the Cleveland Orchestra as apprentice conductor and assistant conductor up till 1970. Levine was a faculty member of the Cleveland Institute of Music as well. He made his Met debut in 1971 and was named principal conductor just 2 years later. In 1989, he conducted the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra on a performance of Gustav Mahler's Resurrection Symphony recorded in Tel Aviv. Levine was often compared to Leonard Bernstein as a conductor, well known outside the rarefied precincts of classical music. New York Magazine once wrote that Levine is known for quietly establishing an extraordinary rapport with his musicians and a single-minded devotion to a composer's conception. His professional career was closely tied to that of the Metropolitan Opera. and the tragedy of James Levine's fall from grace is quite extraordinary. He's gone now. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Seth Farber, is the founder of E-Team, an organization that works on religion and state issues in Israel. He's an Orthodox rabbi ordained at Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University, got his bachelor's from NYU, an MA in Judaic Studies from Yeshiva University, has a PhD in Jewish history from the Hebrew University, is, like most Jews, highly overeducated, and has worked as an important social activist on religion and state issues in Israel through his organization, E-Team. Tell us a little bit about founding E-Team and what E-Team is working on now.
Okay, so first of all, thanks a lot for having me on the program again.
It's a pleasure.
I would just say it as a caveat that my mother of blessed memory didn't think I was overeducated. I could always be a lawyer and a doctor.
That's right. That's right. And if you're not so smart, okay, a rabbi is all right, but you know.
Exactly. So E-Team was founded really to, ironically even, empower people in Jewish life in Israel. You would have thought that after 2,000 years returning to the Jewish homeland, we would have gotten the Jewish thing right. But remarkably, a large swath of the of Israel's Jewish population feels incredibly disenfranchised from Jewish life. 72% of Jewish Israelis say that they're not satisfied by any means with the rabbinate's functioning of or controlling Jewish marriage in Israel. Even though 91% say it's important or very important for them to be buried in a traditional Jewish burial, you know, with a Chevra Kadisha and a Tara and the traditional Jewish burial practices. But in the latest surveys, 80% of Jewish Israelis say the rabbinate is the least trusted government organization in Israel. They are trusted less than the Ministry of Finance. They're trusted less than the Knesset. They're trusted less than the politicians. So Israel has a long way to go in terms of making Jewish life not just palatable, but meaningful for Israel's Jewish citizenry. E-Team was really founded originally to help individuals. I founded it in 2002, was to help individuals navigate Jewish life in Israel. Israel provides Jewish life services for its citizenship. Unlike, let's say, North America or Tucson, where you know, you have local rabbis and they're given power by the community to help individuals perform their Jewish life services. Here, marriages, burials, births, etc. Here in Israel, the model is completely different. Everything comes from on top. There are very few community rabbis. There are even fewer paid community rabbis. But the government pays rabbis to kind of perform Jewish services, and it all starts from the top. So the pyramid is kind of inverse. What happened to E-Team over the years is we've pivoted. We stopped working only on the individual cases, but we've also started working on trying to change things systemically here. We want Israel, as a Zionist enterprise and a Jewish enterprise, as the realization of the Jewish vision of the last 2,000 years, we want Israel to be respectful and responsive to the Jewish needs of the Jewish people. So over the course of time, E-Team has grown from a two-person shop to more than 25 full-time people, including five full-time lawyers. We have an assistance center, which is a call center, that helps more than 5,000 people a year navigate Jewish life when people don't know how to get married or how to get buried or how to convert. We help them, we accompany them through these processes, and we do it all for free. We have a legal division that works on litigation to improve Jewish services in Israel that the government provides, and we've had some major successes in that area. We have a public policy division that works with policymakers and Knesset members. Just this week we had a very, very large conference with, I think, members, leaders of seven or eight of the parties that are running for election this week, and all of them very focused for the first time, because the major focus now is, of course, Corona and the economy, but focusing, sure, again, the issues on Jewish life and religion and state issues. And we also have a conversion court. It's an Orthodox conversion court that, to some extent, is this is a tough word to use, but it's actually competing with the Israeli rabbinate. Conversion in Israel is a particular
fraught issue.
Maybe we can talk about that issue, you know, in a couple of minutes. But in this country, I'll just mention the statistics, because of what I perceive to be the blessing of the immigration of 1.1 million Jews from the former Soviet Union between 1988 and 2004. Those are the people that, you know, when I lived in the States, I immigrated to Israel some 25 years ago, but before that, I lived in the States and I was involved in what was called then the Soviet Jewry movement and, you know, trying to help people get out of, you know, from behind the Iron Curtain into Israel. You know, I grew up on the slogans 1, 2, 3, 4, open up the iron door, 5, 6, 7, 8, let our people immigrate.
Yeah.
And marching and
I remember
like that. Right. So a lot of the people who came here, there's some questions about their Jewish bona fides. There's real questions about whether they are halachically Jewish and therefore they can't get married in Israel. And since 2000, the government in Israel has tried to provide a conversion program for them. These are people who have very strong Jewish identities. Many of them suffered under anti-Semitism, but there are serious questions about their halachic Jewishness, and that means, again, they're deprived of some rights in Israel. We want to fix that if we can. The government has not done a good enough job, frankly, in enabling an Orthodox conversion that would be that would meet these people where they are right now. And because of that, we, the team, opened up a program called Gyur Halacha. Right now, we started with 6 Orthodox rabbis, primarily rabbis who work for the government, you know, with municipal rabbis and city rabbis and rabbis of settlements around the country. We're up to 70 rabbis that have joined us in this effort to basically, I would say, recognize the incredible miracle of what we call the ingathering of the exiles, but it's essentially the incredible miracle of the immigration of hundreds of thousands of people who have strong Jewish identities but were cut off from Judaism for generations. And we want to welcome them back and give them full opportunity and rights here. So those are our 4 programs, the Assistance Center, the Legal Center, the Public Policy Center, and the Conversion Court. And thank God we've developed a reputation for honesty, transparency, and respect, which is really an important word for me in terms of treating everybody who calls us with respect and trying to understand where they're coming from.
It's a remarkable organization. I want to come back because obviously personal status issues have been a flashpoint in Israel for a long time, and not just between non-Orthodox aspects of Judaism. There have been stories that Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, whose conversions were rejected for a while, Orthodox rabbis outside of Israel's conversions were rejected within Israel. Tell us a little bit more, in addition to the issue of the former Soviet Union Jews who have taken, that process has taken, seems like, forever to really address in a serious way the conversion issue. Tell us a little bit about where things stand now on conversion.
Well, in the 40s and 50s and even 60s, Israel was a very small country. It was all very mom-and-pop shtetl-like. As things grew in the 70s and the population grew more, the local rabbis who were in charge of certifying people for marriage, by law, the law gives local municipal rabbis the right to perform marriages. There's no civil marriage in Israel, but religious marriage is counted as the equivalent of civil marriage in the States. And those rabbis stopped really recognizing all the people, you know, who lived on their street. And as the North American Aliyah picked up, as immigrants started coming from North America, more and more people were encountering difficulties trying to prove their Jewishness. This was particularly the case when it came to conversion issues. When you had North American immigrants who had converted in North America and then coming here, and they were being told, even though they had managed to traverse the issues of making Aliyah, of immigration as converts, then they were being told, hey, your conversion isn't good enough, or your rabbi isn't good enough for rabbi. This really reached a crescendo with the story of Rabbi Lookstein. The truth is that I'd been not just monitoring the situation, but trying to move it forward for a number of years when Rabbi Lookstein called me one day and said, you know, we have a very, very long relationship and our families go back a long time. And he said, Seth, sorry, your first name in Israel, I'm Shaul, here I'm Seth. Right. Here I'm Seth. And he said, Seth, Can you help me? One of my converts is trying to get married and is being told that she has to convert again. And how could that possibly be? And Rabbi Lookstein really, we partnered with him, and not just with him, but with a number of rabbis, a large swath of Orthodox rabbis, to basically try to convince the rabbinate that they had to be much more transparent about how they deal with conversions. They need to understand better what's going on than what I would call the North American narrative. I don't expect the rabbinate today in its current constellation to understand the full North American Jewish narrative. It's unfortunate that they don't. But as the rabbinate got bigger and bolder and more powerful, they tended to dismiss American Jewry more and more. Everybody there was, you know, Tris, as far as they were concerned. What we tried to do is try to kind of open a small window into North American Jewry by pointing out to them that rabbis, like Rabbi Lookstein, and not just like Rabbi Lookstein, but many, many rabbis in the Orthodox community who performed conversions were performing conversions that were to the rabbinate standards, but the rabbinate simply was unaware, or they were getting bad information, or they were getting no information. At a certain point, so it really affected thousands, tens of thousands of people even, and we were getting calls from people whose kids were coming to convert, coming to get married, whose moms had converted 25, 30, 35 years ago and had grown up completely Orthodox, day schools, etc., who were being denied the right to get married here. Over the course of the last, I would say, 5 years, we've gotten the rabbinate to come around to a certain extent, meaning they're much more transparent about how they handle things. They publish protocols. We actually filed a legal case to have them publish the protocols of their internal meetings so we can understand better how they think and how they work so that we can improve things in Israel. Rabbi Lookstein's conversions, for those who followed this story 4 years ago, so thank God his conversions were all recognized. But we still have a long way to go in terms of opening that window more. I'm a big believer in understanding and transparency. We can disagree, but there has to be honesty and transparency, and that's something that, unfortunately, the rabbinate is a little obstinate about. And because of that, there's some major challenges still, particularly for converts, but also for just people who, you know, make Aliyah as Jews, who were born Jewish. They don't trust every rabbi, they don't trust every letter, etc., and it's a very complicated process that fortunately, ET, my organization, is here to help people, you know, navigate it.
There was a joint conversion program for a little while, which included Orthodox, Masorti, and I think Reformed rabbis as well. That kind of fell apart because things weren't recognized. There was pressure to break it up. With this new Supreme Court decision, do you think this will have lasting impact on the rabbinate? They say that it doesn't affect religious matters, it affects citizenship, but do you think this will have a serious impact?
So it's really a great question. It's a little too early to tell. The Joint Conversion Authority was established in 2000 to kind of address the issue of the Soviet Jews that I mentioned before. It didn't actually disappear completely, but it morphed into something that basically gave the rabbinate full control, with the Reform and Conservative communities kind of going back and saying, well, we don't really need this. We'll just continue doing our own conversions all the time. So something that actually had some promise at the beginning about everybody working together, but it never demanded that everybody kind of give up their own fiefdom. So that enabled the Reform and Conservative and the Orthodox communities to continue doing their own conversions. And what's happened now is that the Conservative Reform communities have significantly more momentum in terms of their conversion. They still understand that the so to speak, if you'll forgive the phrase, the Holy Grail is to be able to perform a conversion that someone would be able to get married here. That would require changing the marriage law in Israel, not the conversion protocols in Israel. Will it have lasting implications? It's really too early to tell. Right now, what's going on is frankly is painful. This decision has exposed a certain divisiveness within Israeli society, and that's on the back of converts. And that is the worst thing. In the days following the decision, a conference that I ran at ETIM, one of the ultra-Orthodox members of Knesset got up and said, conversions that are performed by the state as well, within the context of the IDF, all the women there are not really Jewish either. He later apologized, but it's accentuated all the extremism. And I believe that not just conversion, but the issues of Jewish life in Israel, if you had to, you know, pin me down to one statement that's my passion, it's that Jewish life in Israel ought to be something that binds us together and not something that's divisive. So will it have lasting implications? Right now, this is a divisive decision in some ways. From a legal perspective, of course, it's totally, totally the right decision from a legal perspective. Meaning, once the Orthodox private conversions were accepted for civil purposes, such as making Aliyah, there is no reason in the world the Reform and conservative conversions shouldn't be accepted. But over the long term, I have a bigger vision, which is that the issue of reform and conservative and orthodox, that's all 205 years old, if that. Right? It started in 1808 or 1819, depending on which historian you ask.
Right.
And our community, our Jewish community, is stronger than a 200-year aberration. And maybe not just Supreme Court decision, but I'm hoping that the work I'm doing is trying to build bridges and mend fences and not just create more divisiveness. So again, I'm not blaming anybody. I think it would be the ultra-Orthodox completely overreacted to the Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court decision affects only a handful of people a year. I'll tell you something, Rabbi Cohen, to the listeners that you'll, that I used to illustrate this. As I mentioned before, I founded some of the most prominent rabbis in the religious Zionist community in Israel, a private conversion court known as Gior Kalacha. In the 24 hours from the moment the decision was passed, was published on I think it was Tuesday night this past week, Gior Kalacha, the conversion court that I'm involved in, we converted 18 people
right
in those 24-hour period, which was more people than appeared in the brief over 15 years.
Yeah.
So in other words, the real issue is not a handful of people who convert, reform, and then want to make Aliyah. The real issue is Jewish destiny. The real issue is what is Jewish life going to look like, not tomorrow, but in 20 years or 50 years from now. And that's something that I think that needs to be worked on, not by fighting and not by court cases, although I'm willing to go to court, but by consensus and by people understanding and transparency and most important, respect for one another. I think that in Jewish history, in the times of the Temple, different courts performed conversions, and each court had a respect for the other one and recognized the other's conversion court, even though they didn't necessarily agree with all their policies. But there was a certain amount, there was a modicum of respect where everybody said, we can do this together. And I believe that in the end, for the future of Jewish world, not just Jews in Israel, but for the future of the Jewish world, we need to be working much more together than working apart.
From your mouth to God's ears and to the ears of the other Jews. I want to thank Rabbi Seth or Shaul Farber for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about E-Team?
So if you just Google E-Team Jewish Life or my name, you'll come to our website. We have a website in English. You can read all about some of the things we're involved in today, some of the cases we've taken on in the courts, some of the things we've done in the Knesset, and testimonies from literally more than 50,000 people that we've helped traverse Jewish life in Israel and make their Jewish experience a better, deeper Jewish experience.
Thank you so much. Chazak v'amatz. Keep doing this great work.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be David Hirschberg, an entrepreneur who's now a novelist. His second novel, Jacobo's Rainbow, was just released. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Festival of Passover, Saturday night this week. Don't miss our upcoming Apart Together Seder at the Rabbi's Table with me at Congregation Beit Simcha on Facebook Live, a fantastic version of the Passover Seder, a great way to celebrate the Festival of Freedom. Go to Beit Simcha Tucson on Facebook and sign up. This playout is a parody for Passover 613's version of Frozen called A Chosen. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a week we pray of health and of peace, and a Chag Pesach Sameach, a happy and healthy holiday of Passover.
Desert that night, but the water, it was red. The kingdom was full of locusts, with frogs jumping in their beds. Do The Jews were slaving, building Ramses and Pito. Moses said, it's time to say Shalom. Pharaoh said, no, don't set them free. He was a bad guy who brought us misery. But God's strong hand began to show. And thus said Moses, let him go.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.